Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shoup.
And I'm Coach John Shoup.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond the sound bites and highlight reels.
This episode of Going Deep, we are thrilled to have a dear friend of ours. One of the gifts of a life in sports are the people that are kind of like family to us that we've just met and we're kindred spirits. And so we welcome today Natalie Graves. She is here to help us go deep around our conversation of mental health and sports. She hails from Chicago, and she is here to help us learn more about what it looks like on the ground to support athletes in their mental health. So welcome, Natalie, and I'd love for you to introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell them a little bit about you and your practice and what you do.
All right. Well, I have to just say thank you so much for having me. You guys are some of my favorite people, and it is really, really an honor to catch up, but not only to catch up, but to talk about this topic that is near and dear to my heart. So I'm just happy to be here. But a little bit about me. I am born, raised, and educated in Chicago. And have a private practice where I specialize in working with athletes at all levels. Youngest athlete right now is 12 years old, a gymnast. I work with high school athletes, college D1, D2, D3, professional athletes. I have two Olympic hopefuls on the caseload right now, along with retired athletes. And that would include male, female, independent and group sports. And my focus is not just performance, but that is a part of what I do, but the mental health side of athletes as well. Because I believe in working with athletes, we have to look at the whole person. And so that is a big focus in what I do. And I do some speaking nationally and internationally, working on a few projects. And I'm just all things mental health and sports. And my favorite top title, I'm a sports social worker.
Yes, ma'am. That's why we love you.
And when we were in Chicago, you were a Chicago fan. So that was good, too.
Yes. All things Chicago, for sure.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that we've been trying to sort out in this world of COVID, we certainly realized I'm teaching at a high school right now, and I help sometimes coach with the football team, but even our daughter, who's a high school athlete right now, and our son, a professional athlete, is trying to figure out that sweet spot. You know, competitive sports during COVID has been a problem. It's been hard in so many ways, because sports can be a mental release and be very helpful to athletes and can benefit people in so many ways, chemically with endorphins and physically, spiritually in so many ways. But it also can work the opposite way. And I wonder if in youth sports, in college sports, and even in professional sports on the different levels, if you can kind of help us navigate trying to find that sweet spot in competitiveness where it's healthy and still gets the juices flowing and is beneficial, but it's fragile too and doesn't tilt over the edge.
Can I add a little bit to that question?
Of course.
So this for me, because I'm coaching high school cross country. I'm coaching our daughter, but and all those years we spent in football, and I was a collegiate athlete. Our son is now a professional athlete. the sweet spot where it doesn't tip over into this life diminishing reality, because there's so much pressure. There's so much stress. There's so much tension. There's so many expectations. Like the better you get at something, the more people expect of you. And it seems like we're seeing with some elite athletes these days, they're really saying, well, that I've had enough. I want to set a boundary. This is no longer life-giving for me. I need a break. How do you find that sweet spot?
I love that term, the sweet spot, because that is really, really what it is. The term I use is finding the balance, but we're talking about the same thing. So, you know, John, when you said, you know, sports is this wonderful thing in so many ways. But then there's this other side of sports, though, that we don't always acknowledge. And the expectation is really a big part of some of the issues that start to come up. Athletes put expectations on themselves already. And then you have the teammates, and you have the coaches, and you have the fans, and you have social media. And so trying to find that sweet spot, trying to find that balance, is really imperative to really keep you healthy mentally and to help you continue to perform, because there's a lot of noise out there. And it's not just distracting, it can be destructive, right? And so we really have to teach our athletes on all levels, you know, when to kind of cut things out, shut things down. Sometimes we have to go into tunnel vision, and sometimes we have to actually evaluate where we are currently. And do we need to take a pause? Do we need to take a break? Do we need to do something different for the athlete's mental health? And I think we're finally starting to talk about this. We're starting to have real conversations about it, because for many, many, many years, for so long, athletes weren't even looked at as human. They were machines that just had to go and perform and entertain. But that's just the small piece of what an athlete is. And so, you know, this mental health piece and talking about the sweet spot and balancing, if we continue to ignore, then we're going to constantly see some of these issues that are really coming to the forefront right now. And I am really, I've been very outspoken with a lot of the things that have happened over this past summer with a lot of these elite athletes. And I'm sure we'll get into that. But we have to create a culture in sports that allows folks to be human. And I am big on asking for help is a strength. It's never a weakness. I try to constantly send that message. And so when we're trying to find the balance, when we're trying to find that weak spot, specifically when it becomes a job, when it becomes no longer fun, when it is weighing on you heavy, we need to take a pause and evaluate, should we continue to do this? And particularly, I see this in youth sports, not just on the collegiate and professional level. You know, I wrote a blog years ago about, I think, something like do's and don'ts with parents, sports parents. And it is surprising that athletes at the age, many athletes, by the time they get to 15 years old, 14, 15, between 13 and 15, I believe, they will leave their sport because of the pressure. And so if we think about that, a sport that kids love, they are walking away, running away in some cases, because it is just no longer entertaining. So many situations where I have met with athletes, and when they have a moment to themselves and it's just he and I or she and I, and we really began to talk about the love of the sport, I've heard many times, it's a job. It's not fun anymore. And I'm talking high school level. And so if we're at the point where our young athletes are feeling like this is a heavy duty task, we have to step back and say, do we need to do something different? Do we need to have a conversation? Do we need to reevaluate how we're interacting with our athletes? How are we communicating with our athletes? Because sometimes just because we love them and we love the sport, we may say things that put more pressure on them. And I know that because I'm in a sports family and I've had to, you know, go to my family members and say, you know what, let's pull that back. He doesn't need to hear that right now. You know, he just lost the game. Let's pull it back. You know, and so we have to start thinking about, you know, how are we interacting with our athletes? How are they feeling game in and game out? How are they feeling during practice? You know, and if there are some things that are coming up, we don't brush it off. We've got to take a pause and talk about it.
I think you bring up there's a lot of things that you're saying there. And I want to kind of go back to one thing that you said at the beginning. And when we were in Chicago and I was the offensive coordinator of the Chicago Bears, it was, you know, we were at Chicago from 98 to 2003. And it's really right as the internet was starting to take off in chat rooms and the social media type of criticism.
Yeah.
And it was really hard on me. I remember as a young offensive coordinator, it really beat me up. And people would often say to me, well, you can't listen to that. But it's really hard not to, even if you're not on the computer following it. I mean, it's hitting you at restaurants, at traffic lights, at stops, at home, in different places. And so what are ways that here 20 years later, the social media thing is increased exponentially. Exactly. So what ways do you tell young athletes or even older athletes, how do you get in that tunnel?
Yeah, it is easier said than done. And I will say before I go into it, John, we could use you on the Bears right now, but that's a whole different conversation that I would love to have.
Don't say that too loud.
This won't go well in Chicago. Although,
I think Shoop's still a cuss word in some parts of Chicago.
Well, now in 2001, we went 13-3, and they haven't been 13-3
since. Well, honey, I'm not saying it should be, but we know how people are.
I like what Naomi Osaka said. She has a Twitter account and she will tweet and she will totally delete her account. Not her account, but she'll delete it off her phone.
And Naomi Osaka, just so our listeners know, is the young tennis player who withdrew from the French Open. We actually talked some about her in our last episode. Sorry, Natalie, please go on.
Yeah, for sure. She may be ranked number 3, number 4 in the world right now. So and gets a lot of criticism for a lot of different reasons. And I thought that was very clever that she still, you know, this generation grew up with social media. That is a part of their life. They're not going to stop doing that. And I don't think that's a realistic expectation. But I love that she'll tweet and then she'll delete it. And so she cuts the access of any of the fallout. So I like that idea. When athletes are training preseason, I encourage them to take a social media break to quiet the noise while we're preparing to get ready for the task at hand. That's another thing. I think, John, you said something that is very real. It's there. You, even if you're not trying to hear it, you may just get a notification that pushes through on your phone and you'll read something. That's very real. And so we do have to put it in perspective. Social media has given permission for people to say whatever they want, anytime they want, but they normally wouldn't do this if we were face to face. And so we have to put it in perspective of this is just noise. It's an opinion. And I don't have to feed into that. I don't have to give it power, because when we spend the time reading it, responding, and I'm talking specifically the negative, the toxic, the destructive stuff, right? You know, when we're giving our energy to that, we're giving it breath to breathe. Sometimes you just have to say, you know what? That's what they said. Keep it moving. And I would really encourage, don't look at it. But you do have to understand, as an athlete today, you are going to get detractors, haters, people saying things on your social media, and you have to be able to put it in perspective. That is now a new expectation that athletes have to be able to handle, that we, you know, they didn't have that many years ago, but that's part of it now. And we see some of the challenges. I'm a big tennis fan. And so a tournament, Sloane Stephens, who's an American tennis player, she was so upset because she's reading all the negative tweets and responses after a loss. And I immediately thought, where's the team to say, you know what, let's stop doing that. Because when we take that in, you know, it becomes part of psychologically how we're thinking, or it will affect how we're thinking. And so we have to really, I think the athletes, but the stakeholders, the community around them, you know, we have to do a better job of saying we have to shut some of this stuff down, put it in its place, but we shouldn't be giving it the breath and the energy to thrive. I think we should just, we know it's out there, and just keep going, do the job at hand. Because when I feel, when you're putting your energy into looking at those things, as I say it, when you're looking to the right, when you're looking at the to the left, you're not looking forward. So you're not focused. And so I try to convey, let's focus on what's the job at hand. And anything that distracts, it takes away from the performance and possibly could have some challenges with the mental health.
We'll be right back with more Going Deep on Blue Ridge Public Radio and our guest, Natalie Graves, an athletic counselor from the city of Chicago. You're listening to Going Deep on Blue Ridge Public Radio, and our guest is Natalie Graves, an athletic counselor from the city of Chicago.
There's social media and there's the haters. And then there are all these other ways that athletes are constantly having to compare themselves to others. And with young women doing distance running, it's a lot around weight, body image, and, you know, all their times go on Mile Split, all their workouts go on Strava, and they're constantly like comparing themselves to other people. Oh, look, she ran this much mileage. Literally, some of the girls on the team will just keep running for a few more minutes just so they get the same mileage as some other girl on another team, you know. Right. And I tell them, I say some of the stuff you're saying, but it's kind of a losing battle because that's a part of their identity now. That's like how they build relationships is this comparing thing. And so then their minds are constantly kind of thinking about what I'm not, what I need to get there. Now with some players, it's, I need to get a scholarship. This is my way to get to college. But like with cross country and track, where, you know, scholarships aren't as plentiful as they are in some other sports. But I mean, part of it is just our competitive culture. And I'm wondering, as somebody who's up close to human beings who are really struggling with identity or self-worth or just a sense of well-being, like, is there a way for competition in our current culture to be a healthy thing?
I want to say yes. I really want to say yes badly. But there's a lot of challenges. And you're right with the comparing of the times, you know, in bodybuilding, you know, comparing of, you know, who's lifting what, you know, it's always something that the athletes are looking at. And I think it's part of the negative of social media. There's a lot of positives. And when we're talking about the competition of it, there's so many wonderful things with competition in sports. And I want to believe that those will outweigh the things that we're talking about with the comparison. I think it's very important when we're working with athletes that we also develop the person. A lot of athletes' identity is solely with their sport. And I am a believer that if we were to encourage and foster other things about the individual, that helps with their confidence and their self-image and how they see themselves as not just a sprinter, not just a soccer player, but I also do this well and I get good grades or I sing well, or, you know, I always, when I do my intake, when I first meet an athlete and I go through my assessment process, one of the questions I ask, what are your interests outside of sports? And that's very deliberate that I ask that, because although we want our athletes to thrive and do well and compete hard, if that's the only thing they're focused on, and if something happens, whether it's an injury or, you know, there's, it didn't work out, they didn't start, they didn't get recruited, whatever, to put the pieces back together of who they are is very, very challenging. And so I really like to say you're an athlete and what? Because you're not just that. And so I think if programs began to, you know, have some things that with the athletes that are totally not related to sports at all, if that's even possible, a half a day and we're just doing this, you know, we're just sitting around talking about catching up, or, you know, kind of encouraging that other part of the athlete to come out. Because if it's just about the competition, if it's just about the performance, what happens when that's done? What happens? And I can tell you from my work, it's a challenge trying to find out who you are after the crowd has stopped calling your name, after you're no longer a part of a brotherhood or a sisterhood of a team. And so I think some of the work has to be that it is okay not to just be an athlete, to be an athlete and I think we could do some things around that to encourage an embracing of other parts of ourselves. You know, I think that's the way. I also feel that building confidence in other areas is another way, you know, really kind of highlighting other talents that they don't even realize a lot of times that they have, you know. And so these are little things compared to kind of the major stuff that we're combating. But I think we have to do those little things. They're important.
I think it's really interesting that you talk about being an athlete and both and world, because it's been my experience in college football and in professional football. The coaches that I've worked with were very intentional about trying to force players to keep blinders on. The last thing we wanted, or many staffs wanted, or many coaches I know wanted, was for someone to have an outside interest or be distracted. It was almost like we were the Spartan culture where you weren't allowed to talk to other people. And how does this show up in college? Well, it showed up with coaches chose every class that you took so you could be at workouts and practices when you needed to be, regardless of what you wanted to take. We were going to do what was in the interest of the team. And it also showed up in ways of dictating what players can and can't say to the media, what they can and can't do outside of football and even class, i.e. like going on a weekend trip. Everything is scheduled, even in the off season. I mean, in the off season, a college football player's job is 6 days a week still. There's no 3 or 4 day weekend where you're going away. And what I'm saying is that has been, in my experience, very intentional to keep players contained for a couple of reasons. One, so they focus on football, and two, so the coaches don't get in trouble if players get in trouble themselves. But what I'm hearing is, and it's something that I always believed and tried to do, was you'll probably have better performance as a player if you loosen those reins a little bit and don't try to micromanage every day of an athlete's schedule. And I see that in college, and sadly, I see it some in high school as well.
Yeah, you know, think about it. It's considered a distraction if an athlete has another interest in addition to their sport. That's a distraction.
You're right. Think about that for a second. That's a true statement that you just said with college athletes and pro athletes even that I've worked with. That's crazy.
Right, right. And I think that we have to kind of rethink how we're approaching athletes at all levels. You know, do we want them as just one trick pony? This is all they know. This is all they think about. This is all they can talk about. Or do we want them to have a very diverse and open interest? You know, the famous quote from a sports, someone on one of the cable news show, you know, shut up and dribble. You know, I don't want my athletes to just shut up and dribble. I want them to use their voice. I want them to use their mind. I want them to share their perspective. And that's a good thing. And I think when we allow the brain to actually learn in different ways, it actually enhances when you focus on something, you know.
But amen.
We've got to reinvent how we're doing this thing if we're really about helping athletes excel on and off, in and out of the sport.
By this both-and approach, it will enhance it. We're not in 1970 anymore. I mean, the world's different right now.
The world is very complex from 1970.
Right. Woody Hayes and Bo Schembechler no longer coach in the Big Ten. It's a different world.
Well, but the most important learning, I feel like, that maybe coaches will start to download is it's diminishing returns. At some point, you're going to get what happened with Simone Biles, where she's like, it's the Olympics, but I ain't competing today because I don't want to die.
Yeah.
You know, like, it should never have to get there to that place. But if coaches can start to see, if a coach at a high level, because it's a business and those coaches don't want to get fired. I mean, it's all connected, you know. But if coaches can start to see, oh, we'll actually have more sustainability, they won't get injured as much, they'll perform better, they'll encourage their teammates, like, all of this is part of a success plan, then they'll do it.
Right.
What I often say to coaches, because winning is their focus, and you know, it is a business, and you know, it is, we're talking about their livelihood. And so what I try to explain to coaches is that if they're allowed to be their best self outside of their sport, they will do well in their sport, and that will help you win. And so now we're all winning. We're performing well. The team is doing well. They're doing well outside of the sport. And that's the holistic that I'm hoping that we'll really start to adopt more. But we do have to understand it as a business. And if it is perceived that this will affect the bottom line, folks will not be open to it. But if we can explain about well-being and how that's connected to performance, there's a door that can be cracked open and a conversation can happen, an introduction of programming and folks that do my work, working with athletes, can get in there and provide that support and those other things that are needed. And I will say, we're now at a time where before where I had to convince a lot of folks of what I'm doing and how it's needed and it's important. Mm-hmm. People are calling me. Coaches are calling me. Programs are calling me to say, we need some support. Our athletes need some support. We actually want you to talk to our coaches. You know, these are universities that are now reaching out that 4 years ago, 5 years ago, that wasn't happening. I mean, I was really having to explain in detail and you know, go through this whole thing. But mm-hmm. There is a shift happening now. Is it where we need it to be? Well, no, we're not there. But I am definitely seeing some changes that I never thought I would have an athletic director or associate director call me and say, you know, mm-hmm. can you help our athletes? That's new.
So what would you attribute that to?
I think the culture is getting more aware of mental health. I think it was the summer we had with the injustice, and yep. athletes were feeling that deeply. It was in their communities. It was people that looked a majority like them. I think it's COVID. There was a lot of isolation. And we know with isolation, we get we're at risk for other mental challenges. And then when it was time to return, there was an increase of anxiety with performance. So I think it was some of that. I think we cannot underestimate when professional athletes began to speak out about their own mental health challenges, mm-hmm. how that really impacts organizations and programs and schools and individual athletes. I will tell you, when Simone Biles, the gymnast, the Olympic gymnast, mm-hmm. who had to put a pause on her performance at the Olympics, when that happened in that week, two athletes on my caseload walked away from their sport.
Wow.
And I cannot ignore that during this time when she did that, that this started to come up. And I think she gave athletes permission to say, it is okay to put my mental health first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so when professional athletes, elite athletes speak up and they take a stand or they just decide to take care of themselves, I think programs began to really take note. And then it's also, guys, it's really about understanding that there is help. There is support. You know, right. I specialize in working with just athletes. I'm not the only one who does that. So like also educating folks, parents, coaches, programs, that there are specialized clinicians out here that can do preventative work. Let's not even get to the intervention. Let's be preventative, right? So that we can provide the support and all the things that is needed to help our athletes perform. And when something happens, let's have someone in place.
You define yourself as like an athletic counselor. I wonder if that has a less, I don't know if taboo is the right word, but it might be kind of name than like a psychiatrist. If I'm going to see an athletic counselor, I feel like I'm almost going to see a mental health coach. You refer to yourself often as a coach. Yeah. If I were to say I'm going to see a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or something, that might have a different, I don't know what, feel, I guess, is the word. Are you finding that what you call yourself is meaningful?
No, John, you're tapping into something really that I was really conscious of. The name of my practice is Natalie Gray's Athletic Counseling. And I purposely use the word counseling I didn't say therapy. And I took a moment and thought, what would be approachable? What would be the least threatening title name that athletes, coaches, athletes' parents could reach out to? And I was very purposeful in thinking that, because stigma in sports is very, very real. And so if we're to, and when I say we, mental health professionals, clinicians who want to do this work, if we want to do this, we have to be able to speak the language of athletes and we have to be approachable. And so, yes, there is a lot of taboo with, you know, using the word psychology, psychiatrist and such. You know, I spoke at a professional symposium. I won't say which one. And I wasn't allowed to say mental health or mental illness.
Hmm.
I was brought in to talk about these things.
Wow.
But I wasn't allowed to say the words. I had to say wellness. You know, and so, yes, John, it definitely, there is some stigma there. A lot of times, you know, when folks call me, you know, I ask them to call me by my first name. You know, I don't get into all the titles, and you know, it's great to have receipts, and I got receipts. That's fine. But I'm gonna tell you, athletes are not interested in what's behind your name. It's what's in your heart and what can you do to help them. And so we have to have a mentality of meeting athletes where they are and get them in the room, or in my case, virtually, to be able to sit down and deal with it. And if I can't get you in front of me, we can't do anything. We can't do any work. So being approachable, yeah, it's so important, because people are you know, searching, and they can just swipe away and never even think about it, you know. But if you feel, often folks will say, you know, something about how you said something, it just kind of, I connected with it. Well, it's important that we understand that. And I emphasize this, John, for a reason. Athletes are less likely to reach out for help than their non-athlete counterparts.
Hmm.
They are more likely to struggle with a mental health challenge than their, on the college level, than their non-athlete counterparts. And they're least likely to reach out for help. So these things matter about relatability. Can I connect? Can I relate? You know, what does it mean if this title or that title? You know, I try to kind of get past all that and say, it's about me and you. What do we need to do? What do you need?
You're listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century. Our guest today is Natalie Graves, a sports social worker. Welcome back to Going Deep, where we're going to continue our conversation with Natalie Graves, a sports social worker from Chicago, Illinois.
It's funny because I think sometimes to myself, I don't know if you've watched The Sopranos, but we, over COVID, we watched The Sopranos.
But we just anyhow, needed to feel more depressed about humanity. That's all.
His friend, the people that he worked with, when they found out that he was seeing a psychiatrist, a shrink, that the language of that made him very vulnerable, made him very scared. And I can remember leaning over to Marcia saying, that's just like the NFL. He ought to just be seeing not a shrink, not a psychiatrist. He ought to just be talking to a friend, you know, call it something else. And, yeah. I think language is important. Thank you, Natalie. Thank you.
Well, especially if athletes can say, this is helping my performance. Like I'm
exactly.
Like a sports psychologist, it's a performance enhancement instead of
right.
Like I'm struggling, so I need some help.
I remember as a young coach, I was just 26 coaching quarterbacks at Carolina Panthers, and Steve Berline was a quarterback who was, I think he was 6 years older than me at the time, and he was on our team. And I remember the first day I met him, he sat me down and he said, listen, I'm going to treat you with respect, do everything. I know I'm older than you. He said, this is the only thing, though. You have to help me get better. If you can help me get better, I'll do anything that you tell me to do. But if you ain't helping me get better, then it's not going to work out. And I feel like athletic counselors, sports, you know, mental coaches can really, wellness coaches can help players get better. And isn't right. that what players want to do? Yeah. Can we, Marsh, can we shift gears here just a bit, Natalie? Because I saw in the news in Chicago, you did a really chock full informative piece on, well, the abuses that were going on in the state of Michigan. As we know, yeah. Dr. Larry Nassar was the doctor at Michigan State. And just recently, Simone Biles and many of the world's greatest gymnasts just spoke in Washington about the issues that Dr. Nassar abused all these athletes for so many years and how it went undetected. And then additionally, at the University of Michigan, Dr. Robert E. Anderson had been working with athletes at the University of Michigan from 1966 to 2003. And much of what had, and he's now since passed, but much of the abuses that he was having with athletes are just coming to light now. Mm-hmm. And you talked wonderfully about everything from red flags to look for, or how coaches and parents can be more aware about issues of abuse and the courage to speak out. Because there's also, with regards to Michigan, not Michigan State, but Michigan, with Dr. Anderson, there's an element that's a little bit odd, because these are male athletes in these, in football and wrestling, who are having to speak out about it. And it's just an added element in this hyper-masculine culture of a fear to speak out. And I got to believe that has to do with why this lasted for so long, and we're not even hearing about it until the doctor has passed.
You know, in my early work out of grad school, I worked with neglected and abused girls. And so on a lot of different levels. And so I take talking about this, and when these things come up, I take it so deeply, because I think about those survivors and those young girls that I worked with many years ago, and the impacts of sexual abuse, how it impacted them. We first have a problem with talking about sexual assault, sexual abuse, rape. We as a society, we have a problem with addressing that when it happens. Something goes on where often the first response is to minimize it or deny it. Not all the time, but a lot of cases, it is minimization or denying it or blaming the victim. So if we're starting from a premise like that, it is very hard for victims, survivors, to speak up and report. The second thing that we need to understand, it is a power dynamic when someone abuses, assaults another person. It is usually an adult to a child, a doctor to a patient, a parent. It's a power dynamic. And so that makes it also difficult for a victim or say survivor to speak out. A lot of times the perpetrators, offenders, will make their victims even more vulnerable, see them alone, take them away from their social circle, see them after the family has left, get access, right? And so it is created so that victims can't speak out. So we have to first understand that. The second thing is that we have to be upfront and down, dirty, honest about this. I was asked, when should you start talking to your children about sexual abuse or sexual assault? And I said 4 or 5 years old. And that may shock someone, but at 4 or 5, children are beginning to communicate and they're being handed off oftentimes to other adults or other mm-hmm. systems, schools, preschools, and that. We have to incorporate, just like we're talking about washing our hands and being polite and all the other things we talk about, we also have to teach children about keeping their bodies safe and what that looks like. Now, you know, in the past, it used to be, you know, well, it's okay for a doctor to do this. Well, we have, you know, these horrific, no longer doctors, but were doctors at the time.
Right.
You know, abusing their title and having access to young people. And in some cases, adults. But it was a leverage with Dr. Anderson. Some of the players, they wanted, they needed a letter or they needed something from him. So that doctor had leverage over that player. So there's a dynamic there. So we have to, in our sports programs, in our homes, we have to talk openly about it and not wait until something happens, but start talking about what's okay, what's not okay, and let's talk about it very openly. This is nothing to be ashamed of. And to demonize the horrific behavior. We should not tiptoe around it. When we tiptoe, it gives an idea of consent when we're quiet. And so I am a big believer in speaking the truth about things that are very uncomfortable. I call them the tough talks. But we're talking about our children. We're talking about young adults. We're talking about vulnerable young ladies and young men. And we need to be real about the predators that are out there. And so when we talk about the masculinity of some sports, for an example, a football or wrestling, it makes it even that much more difficult to report, to say something, because the question becomes, before they even tell anyone, they start to, what's wrong with me? Why did I let it happen? Why did they pick me? You know, what will people say? What will I be labeled? A victim is saying this. And so we have to turn this around and say, no, it's not you that has to be questioned. It's the monster who were preying on our kids. We have not gotten there yet. I am very, very, very passionate about this, because those young girls, when I first started out my first job, that stays with me, the challenges they had of their abuses. And so I believe that in organizations, in all levels, we need to be having conversations and teaching our athletes who to report things to. You know, just like I was saying about explaining to athletes who they need to talk to when they're having some challenges mentally or need some help with performance, who do they report somebody to? That's not being discussed. You know, if something happened with a trainer or a doctor or a coach, who do I go to? Who can I talk? Who's the safe person? Those conversations aren't happening. And that is a big deficit. And it creates risk for these kids. You know, and I'll pause here with this last thought. With the gymnast, with Nasser. Some of these young girls were like 9, 8, mm-hmm. 10 years old. They didn't even know what an exam was. And so they didn't even have the understanding of that they were being violated. Mm-hmm. So we have to do a better job as parents, as, you know, I call it sports stakeholders like we are, to really do some educating and really changing the culture of being silent when we're talking about victimization of people.
thing that I have thought since we went through what we went through at UNC, it wasn't sexual abuse, but it was power abuse, where players just were thrown under the bus with no due process, no advocacy. Since that all happened, I've really thought there needs to be somebody in every university who is an ombudsman for athletes. They do not work for the university. They're there without a dog in the fight, but that's who you go to.
Right.
If you
right.
have tried to report, because like, look what happened at Penn State. Look what happened with the gymnasts. They did report.
Right.
They did report to people.
Systems failed them. That's right.
That's right. The systems failed them. And not only that, there were people in positions of power that had a vested interest in that not being a problem.
That's right.
If you have this, an ombudsman, somebody who is an advocate for athletes, that's their purpose. And if an athlete goes to them, it's confidential. They can ask right. a question. It's not going to affect their playing time. It's not going right. to affect their scholarship, but they can go and talk to somebody and get advice about what do I do? This happened, you know? And like, your clients have you to talk to, but it's like every university needs a Natalie Graves, like who's there for all athletes in the structure of the institution, but not answering to the coach, not answering to the athletic director, because the dynamic, it's just a setup. It's a setup, yeah. especially in Division I revenue sports where there is so much riding on everything looking like it's okay. And I remember talking to the chancellor at UNC about this. I talked to the athletic director about this. There needs to be an ombudsman. There needs to be somebody. Oh, well, there is blah, blah, blah. You know, they tried to tell me, well, this person does it. No, that person, you hired that person.
Right.
That person is your friend.
Yeah.
They're never going to go against you, no matter what, that you hired them because they're loyal to you. That's what football's all about.
Right. That's exactly right.
So I think we need to clone Natalie and have a, and place a Natalie at every Division I sports program and have an independent funding source to pay for all of the salaries for those people, because there's so much going on in those Division I programs, so much, whether it be, I can't take the classes I want to, or I'm hungry. I don't have the food that I need, or they didn't follow through on their promises about my scholarship or whatever.
Right. Right.
Or sexual.
I feel like the assistant coach is mistreating me, but who do I talk to?
Well, I wonder, Natalie, if in closing here, could you paint a picture for us of what a healthy athlete does look like, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, we talked about a lot of heavy, heavy stuff today, but we can't not mention what a positive experience and what healthy athletes physically, mentally, emotionally looks like. And I think that's a great way to end. You know, I always like to explain that being healthy doesn't mean that you don't have challenges, that everything is perfect. It means that you're just dealing with it, right? So, you know, the word healthy, you know, it's kind of relative what one thinks it is, maybe someone else thinks. But, you know, if you're enjoying your sport, if you're trying to compete at your best level, if you love the competition, you're in a great place. When you are coaching and, you know, even in the hard times, this is exactly where you want to be. You're in a great space, right? When you're showing support to your teammates or your opponents, or when you're showing leadership skills, empathy, you know, you're right where you need to be in a sports environment. And, you know, it's okay when it gets tough. It's okay when a challenge comes up. It's okay if, you know, you didn't get it quite right this last time. We just get back up and we do it again, or we ask for some help so people can support us. That's what healthy is, right? You know, and most of the athletes that reach out, you know, it's one thing, you know, it's maybe confidence, or, you know, he or she doesn't look right in practice and that, but the, you know, and I always like to pull back and just say, let's just deal with the whole person and build that person up in the most positive way. And the athletic piece, the performance piece, we'll do that too, but it all come together. And so that's what trying to constantly be healthy is all about from a clinician's perspective. And it's a ton of that's going on. And I always like to end with, if you are challenged or you're struggling, just reach out for help. We are here to support you, and it is totally fine. Never a weakness to ask for help. It's a strength.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.